The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I am Avra Lewis with the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Essence Magazine. The first article is titled, Sick, Yvette Dion Scales the Cultural Barriers That Stand in the Way of Fat Acceptance in Her Latest Book. In Weightless, Making Space for My Resilient Body and Soul, journalist and award-winning author Yvette Dion examines America's relationship with fatness, deftly exploring how fat phobia, particularly as it pertains to Black women and girls, invades everything from our schools to our healthcare system. Here, the culture critic known across social media as quote-unquote free Black girl shares her vision for a more dignified fat future. Essence asks the question, where did the idea for Weightless come from? Yvette Dion responded, initially, I wanted to chronicle my journey toward fat acceptance in the context of the broader fat acceptance movement without focusing explicitly on my relationship to food. Other writers have beautifully written books about unlearning dieting, so I wanted to do something different. Over time, Weightless evolved to be less about myself and more about our broader cultural relationship to fatness and fat phobia. Essence asks the question, why was it necessary for you to unpack fat phobia? Dion responded, it was important to interrogate and challenge our cultural mistreatment and oppression of fat people, especially as my young nieces come into a fuller understanding of their bodies. Fat phobia is such an insidious oppression because it is still acceptable to be fat phobic. If you are openly and publicly racist, there are usually consequences, such as the wave of Karens losing their jobs. But if you are openly and publicly fat phobic, there are no real consequences. You can crack fat jokes, snap photos of fat people in the gym, and misdiagnose fat patients with impunity because we treat fatness as a choice with moral implications. Essence asks another question. In one of the book's essays, quote-unquote, I want a love like Khadijah James, you write about the leading ladies who made you feel seen when you were growing up. Who fills that role these days? Dion responded, Natasha Rothwell, who played Kelly on Insecure, is an inspiration. She's not only a brilliant writer and producer, but she refuses to be pigeonholed into two-dimensional, quote-unquote, fat roles. And, of course, Queen Latifah is still reigning. The Equalizer is one of my favorite shows. Essence followed up with another question. If this book had a soundtrack, what would be on it? Dion responded, Break My Soul by Beyoncé, Diana Ross's cover of I Will Survive, Just Fine by Mary J. Blige, On to the Next One by Jay-Z and Swiss Beatz, and lastly, King Push by Pusha T. Essence asks the question, what does the ideal future look like as it relates to the ways our bodies are regarded and take up space? She responded, fat people deserve to live in a world that accommodates our bodies rather than deriding us. That could look like passing a federal ban against weight-based discrimination in the workplace, the Federal Aviation Administration requiring airlines to either expand the size of seats or designate a specific percentage of seats for fat passengers, and outlawing weighing children in schools. We should also ban dieting ads from television. There is so much that could and must be done, but it all boils down to fat people retaining their dignity. Essence asks the question, what do you strive for most, body positivity, body acceptance, or body neutrality, and why? Dion responded, I strive most for body acceptance, and more specifically fat acceptance, because that has very little to do with how I feel about my personal body and everything to do with organizing with other fat acceptance thinkers, writers, and activists around crafting a world that no longer treats fatness as deviant. Essence asks the question, what do you hope readers will do when they finish Weightless? I hope they begin interrogating their complicity in fat phobia, especially as it relates to other intersections of oppression. I also hope they divorce themselves from seeking thinness at all cost and challenge fat phobia whenever and wherever they see it, Dion responded. The next article is titled Home for the Holidays. The couple behind Brooklyn's Black Market Vintage share their distinctive Christmas decor, reminding us that priceless mementos and collectibles spark joy, especially during this festive season. Going to see the Christmas tree in Rockefeller Center, catching Santa in full costume, dropping off gifts in the living room, handing out presents wrapped in the comic pages of newspapers, family members who have liberally imbibed caroling at the top of their lungs. Endless food, family, and good cheer are the things that come to mind when Janae Handy and Kiana Stewart think about their favorite memories of Christmas growing up. Both raised in Brooklyn, the women say that traditions from the past still inspire them, fill them with warmth, and spread a smile across their faces, not only because those moments were such a big part of their upbringing, but because celebrating and immortalizing lived experiences is a process close to their hearts. Partners in life and in business, Handy and Stewart are the co-owners of Black Market Vintage, an antique and vintage concept shop in the Bedford-Stuyvesant neighborhood of Brooklyn. It specializes in Black artifacts, everything from apparel, art, and literature to decor and ephemera, all meant to highlight our history. Those same types of souvenirs also fill their Victorian-style New Jersey home, which they moved into in 2021, and are a staple of the way they decorate for the holiday season. Vintage red and green luggage sits under the tree, and classic essentials of Kwanzaa observances catch the eye. Now that we have a home, our fireplaces are where we house the Kwanzaa, Kinara, and our candles, Stewart says. And because they are fans of upcycling, they transform old collectibles in innovative ways. The couple uses the pages of classic Black magazines to wrap gifts, for example. They actually compete to see who can deliver the most outside-the-box gift wrap. And while the contest can get comically cutthroat, it's also a heartwarming custom. It becomes a little treat because it pays homage to my dad and his non-traditional gift wrapping, Handy says, but also it inspires creativity. when the stuff we have around us to really make something as simple as gift wrap a little bit more exciting. Plenty, it seems. In addition, they trim their nursery-bought tree with handmade ornaments that showcase portraits of Black people from the past. Stewart crafted them with old wooden frames and scraps from magazines they happened to have in their possession, and infused the whole enterprise with a whole lot of Christmas spirit. They get all sorts of ideas from using the old to make the new, and says it's pretty simple to do, whether you're making family photos into Christmas cards or turning recipes from your grandmother into your own form of one-of-a-kind designs. These can be mounted near the tree or in some way inscribed into an ornament. Says Stewart of how to honor and present beloved recipes. That's something that's thoughtful, that is about heritage, ancestry, record-keeping, and generational memory. That would be a really cool thing to consider. What do you have on hand right now? Handy asked. You can take your framed holiday pieces, whether it be an old ad, whether it be your own childhood photos blown up, or just the jacket of an old holiday LP or vinyl record, and you bring in the spirit. You bring in that nostalgia. So many of us still do have hard copy photos, Stewart adds, just getting red and green frames or black, red, and green frames for Kwanzaa. And assembling those holiday photos or portraits, you can bring those out during the season. Both women love all things Black and old, that's for sure. But Handy and Stewart also appreciate the standard holiday fare when it comes to decking their halls, though their preferences may surprise some people. We are a white light household, Handy says with a laugh about holiday lights. We are Black market vintage, but we like white lights. I don't know what it is, but we are both like, not in here. Not in this house, says Stewart of Colorful Bulbs. They also enjoy putting lights not just on the tree, but outside their residence, adding a wreath to their door, adorning their spaces with garlands, setting up stockings near the canara, placing poinsettias in gorgeous vases, and more. The mix of the conventional and the revamp makes for a perfectly curated decorating scheme for the couple's home and for the season. As they prepare to celebrate their second Christmas in their cozy residence, they are looking forward to the one thing they adore more than curating vintage goods, being with the people they love. The tradition of just having a lot of people around and going to see others, that's something that from childhood till now, we really try to be deliberate about, Handy says, noting that for the past holidays, they've gone from North Jersey to South Jersey to Brooklyn to Queens to gather with family. Hopefully, we'll be able to be in some of those large, spirited atmospheres that haven't really been possible during the last couple of years, but also we are just looking forward to the sense of joy. I mean, every year that just feels like it's the best part. I love it. It's just the cheer of it all. The next article is titled Georgia on the Line. We caught up with Stacey Abrams during her hard-fought campaign to become the first Black woman governor in the nation's history. The support of her community will be key. Stacey Abrams walks into the small office we are meeting in, dressed in a red blazer, an undershirt, and dark gray slacks. I can tell she is ready for the end of this 12-hour-long press day. Regardless of her tiredness, there's no slouch in her walk. She moves through the world as someone who has known her purpose since before she took her first steps. Her winning smile greets me. During my sit down with one of Georgia's gubernatorial candidates, I tell her I am a fellow Spelman College alum, class of 2018, and, like her, a former community organizer. I mention this because I am showing up with my experiences and personal politics in tow. I am here to see what's possible for Georgia. So is she. Abrams is running to be the first Black woman governor, not just for Georgia, but the first ever in U.S. history. She hopes to obtain that win by speaking to the needs of her own people. However, she's not leaning on Blackness alone to win people's hearts. Identity is the opening of a conversation. It is not the conversation itself, she tells me. I don't want someone to vote for me because I am Black, but I want them to understand that because I am Black and because I am a woman, I bring to sit on experiences that are very singular. But you should always investigate who I am and what I say. That's why I'm so transparent and why you may not like my answer, but I'm going to give it to you. She's the only candidate who knows the Black experience like the back of her hand. Being Black often means fighting racism, but also transmuting it to love your people. We must elect candidates who see us, hear us, represent us, and have a commitment to passing legislation that ensures our communities have the opportunity to thrive, she says. The best predictor of what someone will do is knowing what they have done. And I am the only candidate for governor with a proven track record of ensuring that Georgians of all backgrounds are seen and heard in Georgia. Abrams' belief in Black political power began long before 2018, when she first ran for governor. Some would say it goes back to college when she was a young Spelman undergraduate, but Abrams references her childhood to speak about her first understanding of community care. My parents had three tenets they instilled in us: go to church, go to school, and take care of each other, Abrams says. My parents taught me the value of service to others. No matter how much we struggled to make ends meet, we were taught that there was someone with less and it was our job to serve that person. Abrams has been ambitious since then, coming from a family with five other siblings and working class parents, her mother a librarian and her father a shipyard worker. She was born in Mississippi, but her parents relocated the family to Georgia so they could become United Methodist ministers. They always reminded us that our faith should be a shield to protect and not a sword to strike down. This belief still guides me today. In November 2010, Abrams was the House Minority Leader in the Georgia General Assembly, and she had lots of grit when the Assembly's Democratic Caucus elected her to the leadership position that year. She looked at the party's loss in the state's House of Representatives as a catalyst to flip Georgia blue. She spent the next 8 years creating local infrastructure to register voters, and she rallied for assistance. I got on a plane and traveled around the country to meet top Democratic donors, she recalls. I introduced myself and said, look, I'm going to need you to invest in Georgia because we're going to need some investment before we believe in ourselves. I'm going to have some projects and I'm going to need your help. Those projects included the 2014 Voter Access Institute that flipped Republican counties in rural Georgia in both 2014 and 2016. She also led bipartisan legislation around policing and voters' rights that remain in the record books today. While Abrams had a measurable impact in her state, she didn't yet have a national reputation. That is, until she sought to become the first Black woman governor. She didn't take the victory in 2018, but the race fully familiarized her with Governor Brian Kemp, against whom she is running again. The current governor in Georgia believes that mass incarceration isn't a bad thing. She says of her opponent, he has eliminated or cut most of the criminal justice reform advances we made. But Abrams knows that hyperfixating on Kemp's long-standing policy goals is not enough to pull in new voters, because there is a second battle that lives in the space between Abrams and her hopeful win. A lot of Black people no longer trust the Democratic Party. Young people in particular seem to be losing interest in a party that serves up hollow promises every election cycle. They have watched Black voters invest in centrist Democrats who merely perform solidarity for their piece of their pie. They are tired of lip service, and some have checked out of the process. Turning Georgia blue is not all that matters. What remains difficult to navigate for many Black people is if voting is even worth it after the pandemic of 2020, ongoing labor strikes across the country, and uprisings to end the murder of Black people by the state. What is the most devastating response to me is when someone says, "My vote doesn't matter." Of course it matters, Abrams says. You may not win with your vote every time, but you make them work for it every time. That's the point. If somebody's got to work for something, they're not going to ignore you the way they do. There are also Black people across generations who aim to exercise power in the voting booths. The 2020 presidential election, when President Biden secured a victory in Georgia after years of being a red state, made that clear. A melting pot of factors made the moment possible, namely the return of more Black people to the South than we had seen since the 1970s. A focus on registering young voters after Abrams' 2018 loss, and the canvassing and organizing strategy of organizations such as New Georgia Project, led by the brilliance of NCU Foote, Movement for Black Lives, Working Families Party, and Southerners on New Ground. After the setback 4 years ago, Abrams sees her campaign with fresh eyes. "I have had the remarkable failure ever," she says. "I'm not winning. I had a chance to write more. I had a chance to grow my business. I got to be on Star Trek." But her projects beyond politics never distract her from her goals. "I want the job because I want to do this work," she explains. Some of that work is addressing Black women voters who are often touted as saviors, while politicians don't meet their demands. Black women are often on the front lines of change because we are often the victims of inaction, she says. "My campaign, my work, everything is centered on the fact that I will not wait for others to guide my salvation. I'd rather go ahead and solve the problem." This path has been Abrams' dream well before she entered Georgia's legislative chambers. I mean, what, 29 years ago, I spoke at the 1993 March on Washington. I gave some impassioned speech about jobs and justice and peace, she says. "That person wants me to be able to deliver it, and as governor, I can do that work." She has an holistic approach for voters to access resources that will finally put the lives of poor and disenfranchised people at the forefront of policy. Our wellness comes about when we have a governor who controls the resources and the opportunity. In Georgia and across the South, Medicaid expansion is how Black people get health care. So we get metformin instead of amputations, she says, referring to the diabetes medication. We get access to amlodipine instead of heart attacks. Black governors change our lives, and we would know that if we had ever gotten to see it. Black governors can also bring change in ways that some of us would deem detrimental. I finally work up the nerve to ask Abrams about the calls to defund the police. She's been clear that she believes that increasing the wages of law enforcement is a key to holding them accountable. She reiterates her idea with me. I believe that we need correctional officers who are paid a living wage so they are actually doing their jobs and they are not being shaken down by gang members. Or worse, they don't show up to work. The candidate has faced much right-wing criticism for being on the Margaret Casey Foundation board, a philanthropic fund supporting demands to reallocate funds from police to resources that meets people's needs. She stands firm in her position on the board, but insists that her alignment ends there. Beyond her more polarizing ideas about public safety, Abrams has in-depth plans for statewide Medicaid expansion, stricter gun laws, and affordable housing that could save many from unyielding generational poverty. The heartbreak of Obama's presidency taught many young Black people that identity is not enough to guarantee their vote. But Abrams is willing to fight to gain their support. At the end of our interview, as I wait for my Lyft ride, I watch Abrams Jr. staffers leave to campaign. Many of them are Spelman and Morehouse alum with whom I went to school. I am sitting with how critical it is to get Black voters to make politicians actually work for our vote and keep their feet to the fire. Abrams is no exception. I walk away knowing that as I internally debate my Spelman sister, she meets me with honor, honesty, and rigor. It opens up more worlds of possibility than I had when I first entered the office. I leave knowing that while our eyes are fixed on differing goals, we are both simply making do with what we have. Well, we have run out of time for today's episode of Essence. We hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I am Avra Lewis, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Essence is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.